everyone. Welcome. We are Bitches on Comics, and I am S.E. Fleenor, one of your hosts.
I am Sarah Center, your other host.
And I'm Christina Maldonado Badhand. I guess I'm guest today.
Yes! We are super stoked to have Christina here. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. Christina Maldonado Badhand is Sikango, Lakota, and Cherokee artist that hails from Taos, New Mexico. Her passion for community and social justice have led her to create, through illustration, a place in which youth, and particularly Indigenous women, are empowered. She studied for 4 years at the Art Institute of Colorado and is an entrepreneur with big dreams. I can't wait to talk about these dreams! Christina worked as a community liaison with Jeffco Indian Education, is the chief creative designer at Aya Studios, LLC, I left part of it out, and co-producer, I'm so sorry, of Indigenous Pop X, Denver's first Indigenous-centric pop culture and comic art festival. Ooh, 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 ooh. Don't make me cheer for myself, people. I mean, you can. She is also a commissioner on the Denver American Indian Commission and remains strongly connected to local Native and art communities. Give it up for Christina.
All right. I have just one, the biggest question, which I ask almost everybody who comes onto the podcast is, what was the first comic that you remember really hitting home for you? Like, what was the first one that you super got into, clicked with, et cetera?
Well, ElfQuest was a really big one for me. I actually didn't learn how to read until I was about 9, 10-ish. So comic books were really important to me because I could understand the story without having to be able to read the words. I was dyslexic. ElfQuest was awesome because it kind of felt like Indigenous representation in a way that was in like comic books, and I could relate to a lot of the characters. The first ElfQuest book I picked up was actually wildly inappropriate for the
I was thinking that just as you were saying it. My mom used to read ElfQuest, and it was one of our bonding things. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, ElfQuest, how wholesome. And they had those furry crop tops, and then like there was all of those sexy times. How old were you when you were reading this?
I was actually 8, and I picked up the fourth one, which is the Orgy and the War book.
Perfect.
So yeah.
That's the one everybody remembers.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, ElfQuest, did you read the one?
The Orgy?
Yeah, the Orgy. Yeah.
I feel like that's really, you know, they probably leveled that for you. They were like, yeah, third grader, this seems appropriate. Enjoy this orgy.
Well, I actually, I went to a homeschool that the teacher, she taught her kids and all these other kids in her house, and she didn't quite know how to teach third graders yet. So that's actually part of the reason why I didn't learn how to read until I was like in fourth grade. But so I ended up learning a lot about Shakespeare and all the stuff you learn in high school when I was in my third grade. So it was actually pretty inappropriate, some of the stuff we learned, because we saw the original Romeo and Juliet movie, and he stands up, and his butt is, like, right there for all the world to see. And me and the other two third graders in her class just screamed and, like, dived into the pillows.
But
the ElfQuest book was actually one of the older kids had it. So he was in, like, 8th, 9th grade, and he had the first four. And so then I brought home, he let me borrow 1 through 4, and I brought it home for my siblings, and then they loved it, and it just kind of became a thing where we all started reading ElfQuest. And then I loved Wolverine because Wolverine's amazing. But also because the first comic I picked up of his, actually, he battles Unchegula, which is a Lakota sea monster. And so I was like, this is awesome. It's being represented from my culture. And then he speaks Lakota and Japanese. And I was like, yeah, I fell in love with Wolverine from that point on.
Yeah, I was just thinking, too, you really like people with good hair. Because everybody in ElfQuest has really good hair. And then Wolverine, whoosh, the best.
That's interesting. I never made that connection before.
Sarah makes a lot of connections no one else has ever made before.
I'm like, haircuts, right? That was it.
Oh, yeah.
That's what got me, too.
You know, actually, now that you say that, though, it's kind of funny, because my favorite characters, like, anime-wise, are always the ones that have, like, the poofy big hair. Like, Vegeta, Hiei from Yu Yu Hakusho, Shoshomaru from Inuyasha. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I might have a thing for hair.
Well, happens to the best of us.
Glad to be here for this discovery. How did you, because I saw that you had done a panel about, like, ElfQuest, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, was it this last year at Comic-Con?
It was actually at DINC. So,
Okay.
It was Indigenous Knowledge and Social Justice in ElfQuest, and I got to talk to Wendy and Richard Pinney, which was amazing. I totally fangirled out, and I luckily didn't do it on the panel, but all the volunteers thought I was super nervous when I was actually really excited because I was off in the corner bouncing in a circle. And they were like, "Don't worry, you'll do great." And I was like, "Oh, I know. This isn't like nervous energy. This is excited energy.
I trained for this moment my whole life."
Exactly. And actually, we ran overtime. We didn't even get to all the questions that I had for them. We got maybe about almost halfway down the list, and they had a lot of great things to say, and it was awesome. Like, it was probably my favorite panel that I've ever done, and it was kind of such a big circle for me, because as much as I loved that comic, it was also, like I mentioned, very big for my siblings, and my brother's been kind of in and out of, like, being connected with him, because he has a drug addiction, mm-hmm. and so that being able to talk to those two was awesome because it was just like a whole full circle thing for me.
Yeah, I was thinking too because they're like two of the first independent creators I think I remember ever mm-hmm. reading. Like I grew up with a lot of superhero comics around and Archie comics and like, you know, really famous, like, you know, like... I'm trying to say like a corporate in a really nice way, but like you can't. So I was just thinking
commercial.
They were, yeah, highly commercial comics. And then you have ElfQuest, which is like, they did it themselves. Like everything was just, and even to this day is still published through them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Come no, on. It was awesome being able to talk to them. And then I think, because we talked so much about the Indigenous themes they had, I found out a lot about Wendy and her kind of journey being adopted, and she always actually felt very welcomed in powwow scenes. And so being on a panel with somebody who was Native, she thought it was, like, awesome. So she actually gave me a hug at the end of the panel, and I was all, like, total starstruck. I was like, this is amazing.
I feel like what they were to you is, like, what you are to me. I'm like, hi. Is this weird? Is this too much eye contact? Like, I don't know. I can't tell.
That always kind of weirds me out these days now when people are like, oh, I'm geeking out. I'm like, over me? That's really strange.
Let's get strange, right? So I watched your video from I Am Denver, the I Am Denver campaign, where you talked about A Tale of Sand Creek, mm-hmm. which is the comic you made with Pop Culture Classroom for third graders telling mm-hmm. the story of Sand Creek. Man, I just decided we were going to go much darker very quickly.
Yeah.
So
that went from shift. Major high yeah. to like, oh, let's get real serious.
Let's
right
rip
now.
Some wounds open. I'm sorry. Well, not that sorry. So I was just wondering, like, I wanted to hear about what the process of making that was like. I just was obsessed. I mean, the video, I was like, start over. Because you have such an incredible perspective on both framing the graphic novel for a young audience, but also holding to account the reality of what happened. And I think that's a really hard balance to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, so Pop Culture Classroom came to me asking if I could do that comic. So I'm not Cheyenne and Arapaho. And so that's actually kind of the hard part is whenever you get into those stories, people are always feel like they should come from the tribe. So what I ended up doing was I went to an elder in our community who I've known for most of my life, Virginia Allrunner, because she was actually, her grandpa was a survivor of Sand Creek. So he's actually the baby in the comic that got put into the saddle bag and sent off on the horse. And that story was like amazing. So I wanted to interview her. So I spent a few days with her and she pulled out like all of her, she brought out her regalia and she kind of talked to me about all these different aspects that I could kind of put into the story. And then when it came to actually illustrating the story, I have a good contact, George Levi. He's an awesome Cheyenne artist. He does a lot of ledger art. And so everything I was drawing, I was sending it to him, like, is this good? Does this look good? Like, am I doing the right symbols here? Like, are you okay with this? And he was like, yeah, no, that's perfect. And so he had a lot of input on it as well. And it was interesting trying to condense the story into only, like, 2 pages. But I felt like to kind of stay true to that ledger art style, that is, it's Ledger art is basically drawing on soldiers' ledger paper. So if you look at the comic, it's actually on old ledger paper. And I wanted it to stay in two pages so that it wasn't like an overwhelming comic. It was more like an actual flat out story, which is kind of more of a traditional way of storytelling.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. And ledger is in traditional form as well, right? Ledger art?
Yeah, it actually started out on buffalo hide, but during wars and everything, then ledger paper became pretty popular. And there's like most of the ledger paper that myself and my husband have, there's like 100-year-old paper. Wow. It's pretty cool, actually. And this, some of it has like people's grocery lists and cash lists and stuff on it. So.
Well, it's such a different medium to work with, right? Instead of having like a blank canvas or a blank sheet of paper, mm-hmm. to be working on something so old and so personal to someone at some point mm-hmm. feels like a really incredible way to reclaim history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very cool.
How did you get into working and being involved in conventions?
So for Denver Comic Con, the first year, I wasn't actually going to go. I had been to anime cons before, so I'd been to Nandes Con and everything. But I was working at Tokabe, American Indian Eatery, for a bit there, and found out about Denver Comic Con and was like, oh, that sounds kind of cool. I don't know. Maybe I'll go. I've never actually been to a Comic Con. Yeah. And then I found out that Spike was going to be there. Yeah. And so I was like, nope, I'm going. I am going. We're making this happen. And the awesome thing about that was I actually got to meet him and show him a drawing I did of him. And it was during a panel, I used my question to show him my drawing, mm-hmm. and he had the camera zoom in on it, and he, like, broadcasted it to the whole panel, so I left, like, ear-to-ear grin, super excited after that panel. But
is that the portrait on your website?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, it's so good. I feel like it's so real. I thought I would, like, cut myself on his cheekbone. And I was like, Spike.
Yeah, his reaction to that picture was, like, my favorite of all time, because he was like, oh, my God, I look beautiful. it was awesome to be able to meet him. But after that, I liked the Comic-Con feel and everything, and I kind of got curious as to how I could be involved. So the following year, I actually started volunteering and was in the kids' corral. That was crazy, because that also kind of put me on the path of doing education as well, because I ended up in the kids' corral with 25 five-year-olds all wanting to draw different superheroes, and my co-volunteer bailed on me.
Perfect.
And so it was just me and all these kids, and I was there for a few hours and really, really had to pee. So then finally got a chance to run away from the kids' corral. On my way to the bathroom, I actually walked by this booth that said Native American Comics. And so I stopped and met Lee Francis with Indigenous Narrative Collective there. And he was like, yeah, we do Native publishing comics and everything. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. I'm a Native comic artist. And he's like, really? That's amazing. We want you. And I was like, great. I have to pee. And then I ran away. I came back later and showed him my portfolio and then started working with them doing illustration. And then for a short time there was editor-in-chief of that little collective, which then grew into Indigenous Pop-X and Indigenous Comic-Con. And I kind of continued volunteering and doing the exhibitor thing through Denver Pop Culture Con now. And then also started working for Pop Culture Classroom right after that year.
Amazing. So tell us about Indigenous Pop-X.
So this past summer was the first year. We probably are not doing it again this year because I actually walked away from the con. Mm. Just because I actually want to do a little bit more, open it up a little more. What we kind of ended up with Indigenous Pop-X was a lot of people heard the name and they thought it was only for Natives. And that wasn't my intention at all. I was looking at Indigenous as being more everybody. So I was hoping to use it more as a different type of convention where people could connect through their heritage and through different perspectives. Because when you have specialized Comic-Cons like Indigenous Comic-Con where everybody kind of comes and they all have the same opinion, you're not actually reaching anybody when you're talking about issues like Standing Rock and things that people don't usually know about in the Native community. Like, if you are preaching to the choir, everybody comes already knowing. So, of course, they're all going to buy your stickers and they all know everything that you're talking about. It's like you're protesting with people who want to protest that same thing. You're not actually broadening the audience or, like, sharing perspectives. And that's what I was really hoping for Indigenous Pop-X. Lee Francis also sold to Meow Wolf. So there's just been a couple other things that I was like, oh, I wish him luck, and he's still doing Indigenous PopEx in Melbourne, Australia. They had their first year, which looked awesome. It was over Thanksgiving weekend, so that was really cool. And then the next one in Albuquerque is going to be in March. And so he's kind of expanding and building on that idea, but it was always kind of Lee's idea. Mm. So bringing it here to Denver was awesome, and I feel like we got really good roots and we got some good connections from that, but I kind of want to move towards doing another con, so that's my husband and I are planning our own con for next year.
Tell us about that.
All right, so it's called IACON, but it builds off of IPX and kind of more on what we were talking about, where we want to expand it to everybody. So it is independent-based for independent creators, but how we bridge that heritage culture with our current pop culture and basically how you connect with people through art.
Well, I was reading about Indigenous PopEx, and one of the things that stood out to me that you said was that you did want to complicate the notion of Indigenous and say that it means from the land. Mm-hmm. And so everyone is Indigenous in some concept. Do you think that this con will allow you to do that better?
Yeah, I think so. For whatever reason, you know, people heard Indigenous and they just assumed that. And then we had this really funny problem where I was like, it did kind of the opposite, because we'd tell vendors and other artists like to come and apply, and they'd be like, well, I can't participate because I'm not Native. And we'd be like, no, it's for everybody. And we'd explain that whole thing about what Indigenous means. And then they'd be like, oh, I realized I can participate because I have that one story I wrote when I was 12 that has that token Native character.
Oh, no.
And then I was like, oh, no, we don't want you appropriating to feel like you need to fit.
Like that's exactly the complete opposite.
Exactly. Like, that's the opposite of what we were trying to do. We're trying to, like, make it so everybody fits in your own way and you can kind of share your perspective and your heritage, because I mean, a lot of people don't realize that white people have a culture.
And shocking.
It's not like, people kind of think that that's where the appropriation comes from. And that's not. I have a lot of really good friends that are very in touch with their Nordic roots, and they bring that into their comics all the time. And I'd love to be able to highlight that, even like with Wendy and Richard Pinney, when they bring in ElfQuest, there's more than just like that Native American inspiration. They bring in all kinds of different cultures. And it's kind of the whole story of ElfQuest is like very close to Wendy, because it's her own search for identity. And that's one of the things that we talked about on that panel, is being adopted. It was basically how she connected with things. And it was her own way of kind of identifying.
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't realize that whenever I was reading those comics that there was that backstory, but now I'm just like, click, 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 like all of these like little things are happening in my head. ElfQuest was such a good comic. I'm just like now like...
You just want to think
reading
about
Reading back
now?
Through it in my head a little bit and thinking
have
of all
Have you
of my
read
favorite
Final
parts.
Quest?
I haven't yet.
Oh, gosh. Okay, I won't say anything.
Yeah, don't spoil it for me. Don't spoil it.
Yeah.
What are some of your other favorite comics? What are you reading a lot these days?
So I've been reading the Nightmare Before Christmas Zero's Journey, because I love Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, like, I didn't even know that was happening, but he's the pepper, right?
Yep.
Oh.
Yep. It's super cute.
Oh, LOL. Hero's Journey. Not the hero's journey.
No, right. Zero.
Zero's journey.
Yeah, it's the dog.
I forgot the dog's name. Okay. I've seen it once because it really scared me when I was young.
What? Really?
I'm a weirdo. I can't help it.
That's funny. But no, I've been reading that. I got super spoiled by my husband for my birthday, so I just got like a huge book of Saga and the Dark Crystal and Monstrous, and I'm trying to get through all of those because I love reading them, but it's time, so.
Yeah, I'm still like 2 volumes away from the end of Monstrous. Mm-hmm. That ended like last year, right?
I don't know. I think I only got about 3 issues in, but now we have like the big hardcovers, which I'm super excited to read, but I just have not had the time to really sit down and do that. Plus, I have a 2-year-old, so you know.
Reading makes it harder.
Well, and he likes to rip things, so.
And comic books are very easy to keep. No, they're not. Yeah, they get ripped real easy.
Yeah, no, he actually...
He's like...
He kind of dismembered a Sonic comic that we got for free comic book day.
Yeah. Maybe he was just really mad about the film adaptation that looked so terrifying. He's like, no!
He hasn't even
human
seen that.
Teeth!
No. No. I'm making excuses for him. He's a gremlin. He's in the back over there.
What are some of the most difficult things that have surprised you about putting together conventions and doing organizing?
That is a big loaded question. Yes.
Without incriminating anybody who might happen to hear this.
I know, right? I think... No, Norin was amazing, actually. He helped, like, save me during IPX, because that was... A lot of it ended up being on my shoulders just because of the communication.
Sure.
I think one of the main things I learned was having a team that's in your city is super important.
Yeah.
Because for IPX, we were doing a lot of conference calls with Lee, but he was in New Mexico. And mm-hmm. so he missed a lot of the important meetings of, like, doing venue setups and everything. And, you know, part of that is just because of the schedule he had, because he's doing all kinds of stuff in his community. And... That's, I think, the biggest struggle was really that communication piece, was sure. trying to make sure everybody was on the same page and really having, like, a staff that was going to put on the convention. So anybody who's put on conventions and has a staff, appreciate your staff. Yes. Oh, my gosh, they're, like, yeah, that they're godsends, because that's, for IPX, it was mostly, like, me complaining to my husband and then Norin, and then, like... A lot of it was me running around like a chicken with my head cut off.
So. I feel like you're describing, like, every event I've ever, like, had any part of putting together. It's always like, oh, yeah, I should have, like, communicated a little bit better, and or somebody should have communicated with me a little bit more.
Well, and then it was interesting for IPX because we had so much support from the Denver American Indian Commission.
Yeah.
But the commission can't actually put on events in that way. It actually goes against what a city commission does. So they can support and they can create connections and resources, but they can't actually be my staff. So,
right.
Yeah.
Fun.
What were some of the things that you have been pleasantly surprised by it?
I think just the connections that happened. One of the things that was awesome about IPX was there was people talking that I probably never would have met if they didn't kind of talk at IPX. And I made sure that, like, my vendors had chances to kind of connect more so than other conventions. I think watching how other conventions are run, there's a lot of, like, dehumanizing that happens with between guests and between vendors where it's like an isolation thing. Where, like, vendors come, they check in, they do their booth, and then they go home.
Yeah.
They don't actually, like, talk to other artists or try to support other artists as much.
Right.
And there's not very much in convention culture that encourages that.
Right, yeah.
And then it's the same for the artists and, like, the guests. Like, when we had Obar, one of the things he said to us when we were... he said to my husband when they were driving him to the airport was that he liked that we took him out to dinner every night.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually when he goes to conventions, people just kind of, like, check him into the convention and then he's on his own.
Right, yeah.
So that he's completely on his own in a city for whatever he wants to do for dinner and nobody checks in with him or, like, spends time with him.
Right.
And, like, the thing with IPX that cracked me up was even my celebrities. There was actually a day that I lost all my celebrities because they just went off and did their own thing around the convention. So, you know, we had somebody escort them over the first day and tried to do it convention style. And about halfway through that day, they just kind of got up from their tables and just kind of walked around and looked at vendors and just kind of did their own thing. And then the next day, I had that same person supposed to bring them over. And then he was like, I don't know where anybody is. So I'm on the phone with him like, oh, God, did we lose, like, Eugene Braverock and Irene Bedard? Like, I'm, like, starting to freak out a little bit because he has no idea where they are. And then I look over and Eugene's just walking across the floor, like, waving to vendors, carrying merchandise. I'm just like, okay, I guess they're good. And then Irene's wandering around just kind of, like, saying hi to people. And I was like, okay, cool. I guess they're good. Just let them do their thing. And that Eugene and Irene were both super happy because we treated them like people. And as celebrities, they don't get treated like people anymore.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, I've only gone through, like, the photo thing once, but it's like a, what the fuck is happening? happening? The entire, I'm like, wait, who do I look at? What's, and I'm not the celebrity, but I'm like, I'm very nervous. I'm like, and like, I'm like, what is your life? And they're all messy. They're like, I'm famous. My hair's never been done before.
Yeah.
And it's like, everybody's sweating and there's too much eye contact again. And that's probably just me, actually.
I was also thinking about you talking about there being like a barrier between audience and like the tabler. And I was thinking like, oh, is that true? And I was like, every time I've ever tabled anything, I like treat the table like a literal barrier. Like, I'm just like, you will never get past. You will never pass.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between your bubble and like actually being encouraged to talk to people.
Yes.
Yeah, and totally. I mean, artists are, you know, introverts anyways. So if you give us the excuse to hide away in the dark, that's what's going to
happen. Sure. I was like thinking about how we're both like wallflowers and actually very quiet and shy.
Is that not what a wallflower says?
No.
Basically, I'm a cat.
I'm like, do you have any pets? That's my next question.
I'm like, is that a legit question?
No.
I mean, sure, why not?
I mean,
if you want. So, A, I want to talk about your shawl because I can see Hulk. I'm seeing Iron Man. Who else is on there? Is it all the Avengers?
Yeah, actually, it's. It got Spider-Man,
The Falcon,
Iron Man, Magneto,
like one of the Avengers.
Colossus. Yeah, well, you know.
Do I say Wolverine?
Yeah, Wolverine's on
next. Nice.
Yep.
If you could have an Avengers team, who would you choose?
Oh, good question.
To be on it.
Really?
I know, sorry.
Well, obviously Wolverine.
Wolverine's the leader.
Storm.
Captain.
Duh.
Yep. I actually did not like Captain America until I saw the movies.
I was the same. Yeah.
It's same with actually Iron Man and Thor, too.
Yeah.
I would agree with all three of those. Yeah. And I genuinely thought it was a joke when people were like, there's a movie called Captain America. I was like, L-O fucking L. Like, that can't be real. No one would name a superhero Captain America.
Great. What does he do? Love America? I guess we'll just go watch that as a movie.
And then I saw it and I was like, This is great. If this is what being an American meant, fine. Like, I would be on board with that. But it is not.
Because he has a dazzling smile.
Great ass.
Yeah, he's just like...
Torrid romance with Winter Soldier. He and Winter Soldier, lovers for life.
Bucky.
Oh, Bucky, yes. I always forget his name.
Yeah. I guess, back to that question. I don't really know, like, I
mean, like, the X-Men, I would choose the X-Men.
I know, it's a hard question, because there's, like, so many, depends on which universe of Avengers,
too. God, I know.
Ooh, yes, I like that.
So,
what about, like, a loser team? So if you were going to, like, make your Doom Patrol or your Agents of Hate, who would be your, like, losers you would put on a team together?
Oh, gosh, that's even worse. I'm like, you realize how many characters there are. I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't usually do the team thing.
Yeah.
That's like, I don't really do the dream team situation very much.
You know, us either. We just decided we'd break it out.
Yeah.
We're just testing. We've literally never asked anyone those questions. Yeah. We just
or ourselves
well,
even.
I don't think so. Superhero dream team, I'd probably have Wolverine, X-23, yes. Storm.
Yes, X-23.
Approved. Yeah, Danny Moonstar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Danny. I'm
trying to think. There's like... pretty much every X-Men. Honestly, I love most of the X-Men. Nightcrawler is like a given.
What was the first X-Men comics you remember reading?
The Wolverine one.
Oh, yeah. You already said that.
No worries. I got more into the cartoon than the comics when I was little.
We've
and
talked
then
about
as I got
that.
Older, I got more into the comics.
Right.
That was my entry point to superheroes was, well, Linda Carter. Love her, but as Wonder Woman, but really, it was the animated series X-Men,
mm-hmm.
where like that I can just like think of the entire intro.
Right, it was my ringtone for a while.
Oh, it's a good. I'm gonna do that later. Stealing that idea.
Our sound engineer Kate was talking about how that was one on like her playlist, like walking through like the halls in high school and stuff. Just
that's awesome.
Can we play it right now?
Yeah, sure.
I can't remember.
That's a different podcast.
That's the podcast. It's hard to spell, but you can find us at dananana.com. Jokes. God, why do I always, I'm like, oh, pause, let's make it dark. But I actually, sorry, I was looking at your art that was commemorative of murdered and missing Indigenous women. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you would just talk a little bit about the art you created and whatever else you'd like to share about that.
Yeah, well, that particular piece, which I should have just worn that. I have that scarf, by the way. I made that into a scarf, which I'm selling right now, so I should just worn that. But that's okay. This is superhero talk. Yeah. The image actually started out, I did it back in 2012 the first time, and the image that's on the scarf now is actually a revisit. But the first image I had done because I was dealing with the stuff from my family and like my brother and everybody kind of enabling his drug habit and not really acknowledging it. And so it turned into kind of a combined piece where I saw a lot of parallels between how communities deal with news like that or like with issues. So people weren't talking about it, hearing it, or seeing it. And that's why there's the handprints. It's everybody was turning a blind eye to it with my brother. And then I was noticing that was happening with the missing and murdered Indigenous women. And now, thankfully, there's so many artists that are starting to do awareness pieces. So now I feel like it's a topic that, you know, people bring up, but now we need kind of the follow-up, like the action, because a lot of the times people are doing artwork and people are talking about it, but there's still nothing being done for those statistics. It's from, I think it was from 2007 to now, there's 2,400 cases that are completely unsolved. And the particular government agency that was supposed to be handling this just kind of like dropped the ball. They have no information whatsoever on 2,400 disappearances and murders. And there's nothing being done to really follow up on that. So thankfully with like the bill happening and with people are starting to actually try and do things, the average age for women to go missing is 29 to 30. So it's like right in my age. And a lot of the people who have gone missing are young mothers. They're like left behind their families, their sisters, aunties. It's pretty much 18 through 29. And so it's right in that like college age. Yeah. And so with the scarves, I'm actually hoping to kind of partner with community organizations or somebody who we can kind of use the proceeds from the scarves to do something. I'm not entirely sure what that's going to look like yet. Yeah. Because thankfully, when I put it up online and asked for all these organizations, I got like 40.
Oh wow!
So I need to go through and figure out where the best place would be. But I'm happy that I had that many. Because if it was the opposite, where I didn't have anything, I'd probably be like way more doom and gloom right now. I'd be like, oh my god, people suck. But
yeah. Well, people do suck, but you know, they're also okay sometimes. So.
Yeah.
Are there any organizations that you know of that can be supported easily that like you have interacted with or anything that are doing things about this?
There's a couple that help with the families that are left behind, like the kids. I don't entirely remember their names off the bat. But they're super good ones because you can donate and you can help with like the toddlers and younger kids who have been left behind. So it's like, yeah, I'll have to send you guys those.
We'll tweet them out. We'll put them on our website.
Cannot remember what the organizations are called.
We are literally putting you in the spotlight. So.
No worries.
It's okay to forget things. So who are like some of your favorite bitches from comics?
I don't really like, that's an interesting question because I'm like, bitch in my brain equivalents to female dog, necessarily like woman.
Okay, fair. All right.
I mean, favorite female characters. I could go on for a bit. I actually really do love Gamora. Gamora is awesome.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned, Danny Moonstar. I've always loved her character, Echo from Daredevil. Danny Moonstar, I actually really like because it shows evolution. Because she started out super stereotypical, with fringe and talking to animals and bow and arrows, and but then she evolved to being a Valkyrie, to being the head of S.H.I.E.L.D., the weapon specialist. Like, I really like to use her as an example of how things can change and grow.
Right. I first started reading, obviously, like I read a lot of New Mutants growing up, and Danny Moonstar, even in that book, to me, stands out so much because even those first storylines is like Professor Xavier manipulates everybody and like there's like the brood and all of this stuff's going on, but Danny Moonstar is the one who can see through it. Mm-hmm. And to me that like, you know, there's things whenever I read back today where you're kind of like, yeah, it's like not too chill that this like talking to animals thing is kind of weird, but like but whenever I was reading it in the moment, I always like looked up to her because she was like the co-leader with Cannonball too. Mm-hmm. And I think like that time you had Storm as like the leader of X-Men and Danny Moonstar was like co-leader of New Mutants. Yeah. And I loved to watch her because she was this character who held so much responsibility over every decision that she made. Mm-hmm. So there's this moment where everybody is at the Massachusetts Academy with Emma Frost and she's like, what's going on? And she just has to get out of there and she just bounces. And then she spends like the entire next issue, you just see her just like, I never should have left my team, and just having this like huge, huge problem with it. And then holding herself accountable to that. Mm-hmm. And that was around the time that she started taking on like Valkyrie stuff. Like she got like her cool horse, Brightwind, and mm-hmm. like all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Like all of that story arc, I always look back at it as just being, Danny was just like the best mm-hmm. New Mutant kind of. Like they're all really good characters, but yeah. I loved her the best. She was really fun.
Yeah.
And she's the one who's gonna like, I always thought, like, she would be the next leader of X-Men, right?
Because it's, like, they kind of set her up that way, too. Like, yeah. It starts to feel that way.
She's very Cyclops-esque in a way, but in, like, the good...
in the good way, yeah. In no, the good way. I've never cared much for Cyclops.
Sure.
No, I mean, how could you?
Yeah. I don't know. But my husband's working on that. He's kind of changed my mind on a few things.
Nope. It's true. Yeah. The like Cyclops people, they get to you. It happened to me too.
People like were like,
he's like not a jerk. You could like Cyclops. And I'm like,
the only Cyclops I like is the Cyclops who's in a relationship with both Wolverine and Jean Grey.
I mean,
that throuple. Okay. I'm in.
I actually don't know about own. That. What
it's,
is that?
It's like, oh, it's very new.
House of X now. So you have like this scene of like Wolverine standing between like Jean and Cyclops and they're all having like drinks and stuff. And everybody on the internet, of course, like saw this one shot and was just like, well, they're all in a couple now and everything's, they're all hanging out. It's great. Now they also have these like one-liners between like Jean and Emma sometimes where people are just like, they're dating.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, well, they are in my head, but...
So I saw a tweet, I can't remember the person who tweeted it out, but someone who's a comics creator who was saying he literally just got a direction from the company that was like, oh, no, no, these two characters, because they're the same gender, you can't make it explicit. You can imply whatever you want. So I take that as permission to just queer everything I read. Gay, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, all of them. And it's just like, okay, now I like comics better.
It's true. Yeah, they're a lot more fun that way. I saw a very compelling argument that Emma Frost is trans and I will never see the character of this. You know, like,
I know,
I'm
right?
Like, that's how it is now.
I remember when I heard that, I didn't even like need to read Emma again. I just like thought about her and I was like, you're
everything
right.
Makes sense. It's great. Yeah.
And I like that's her even more now.
I'm like, huh. I feel like that's been happening to me a lot lately in terms of X-Men. Somebody, I did a talk on dissecting superheroes on the 2nd of December. Yeah. But somebody brought up the parallels between Professor X and Magneto and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And my brain was just totally like, like, oh my God, now I'm like seeing that. That's really interesting.
Right. So. And like how that was written by people who like were totally like white dudes, right? So you had like them being like, well, this is like what I think that, you know, Malcolm X would say. And then here's what I think that like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, in the time the X-Men came out, there's no way you could have those two characters be actually people of color and have people read it and be as attached to X-Men as it is.
Right. And it was totally 100% like 1963, 1964, mm-hmm. like the exact time of like civil rights explosion. And yeah, it's interesting to think about how that's kind of changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is more room for that conversation between those two characters to go on?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, with X-Men, you could do, like, honestly, you could do, like, multiple panels dissecting X-Men. Yes. Because it's essentially, like, so much in there in terms of social justice and civil rights.
And you're like, oh, they're just, like, all gay. Great. And they're like, wait, oh, they're all a metaphor for racism. Oh, okay. And then they're all, you know, it's like, you can apply almost anything to them.
They're all over the place. But I actually, I'd love to, like, look more into that and kind of, like, dissect it a little more, because the person who brought this up brought it up as a question at the very end of the panel, so I was like, or of the presentation. So I was like, oh my gosh, now I'm gonna go home like thinking all this stuff and like making parallels. It's kind of funny, but I definitely want to look more into it and kind of learn more about that, because mm-hmm. I'm also curious if that was intentional because of the time that it came out.
Mm-hmm. I think I remember reading something that Stan Lee said that was, like, along those lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
So, okay, not a team, but if you could take any character from anything, any comic, any existing property, and take them in a direction that you think is either better or more interesting or just new, who would you do and where would you take them?
I've always loved X-23. So she's, like,
the best.
Yeah, she's been one of the characters that I loved, like, the most, especially just because of her resiliency.
Yeah.
But, you know, also, like, when I started reading her was right around high school, and I actually was a cutter for a bit there because of some of the stuff that happened with my brother, and seeing a superhero cut themselves and actually deal with a lot of the same things that I was dealing with was super, like, important to me. Because then I was like, this is like a superhero, you know, and these are the characters you're supposed to look up to that are like, they're supposed to be tough no matter what. But then seeing a character that was tough deal with like internal pain and like expressing it physically was really interesting to me. And if I were to kind of take her in a different direction, I think I'd like to go away from the new Wolverine, because I'm not a big fan of the way Marvel and DC kind of recolors characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I love that she's kind of followed the legacy of Wolverine, but at the same time, it's a way to hold on to that copyright, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a way to just kind of keep us liking Wolverine instead of developing X-23 further and having her be her own character that we can like and latch onto.
Totally.
And that's that whole talk I had this past week about dissecting superheroes was about that, about how our superheroes are actually, they maintain the status quo. And a lot of the times they're actually like, they solve a lot of problems without people actually having to solve those problems.
Right.
When you have, you have Iron Man, who's like, obviously he does all the tech and everything and he saves the world with his tech. And then suddenly you have Robert Downey Jr. who's saying he's going to solve climate change by doing some universal tech, and suddenly he becomes Tony Stark.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so now people are thinking that they don't have to work as hard at climate change because Tony Stark's going to save the world.
Exactly.
Right.
And you see that kind of play out on film and in comics a lot. And it's kind of their way of putting a Band-Aid on things. Like, we need more diversity in comics. Okay, Superman is now Asian. But he's still Superman, but he's Asian. So you got your Asian superhero.
For a year.
Yeah, and it's the same, like, as much as I love Miles, they did the same thing with Spider-Man. It's like, we need more Black and Hispanic superheroes. Okay, we made Miles Morales, but he's still Spider-Man. So they did it without actually doing it.
Mm.
That makes sense.
Right. I really love that point. You know, it's not, I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about how the Avengers films have set up exactly what you're saying. Like, they make us want to look for an Elon Musk to save us. Mm-hmm. Like, we just got to find the right good guy in tech. He's going to be the one. And it's like, no!
And they're, like, shooting rockets into space and doing, like, weird things.
Yeah, you're actually fucking up our ability to track whether or not we're going to get hit by a meteor. Thanks, Elon. Great work!
Nice work, Iron Man. I wanted to go back, actually. You were talking about Laura Kinney, and something that I think was really interesting about kind of what you were talking about and what I've noticed about that character and kind of what I think the storyline that they were pushing with her was for a minute was, I thought with Wolverine, there's always that, like, he's such a badass and, like, he gets, like, rolled and destroyed and, like, all of this, and he always bounces, like, right back up from it. And I think that's something that they really started to delve into more with Laura was her capacity to still feel pain. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she was also throwing her body into harm because that was what she felt was her job always. Like, mm-hmm. she was the person who was supposed to fix this situation by just being wild and, like, doing the Wolverine thing and, like, punch a sentinel in the face and, like, punch a helicopter in the face, like, all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Punch a helicopter in the face.
Take it out. And doesn't well, he do
she,
that?
She does actually take out a great white shark in one.
I know. Sharks just come up again and we again in this podcast. Sharks. I swear to God, they are all over comics.
Mira throws a shark at someone. America Chavez throws a shark at someone. It's like, these are the things we live for.
There's women a land fighting shark in Deadpool.
Oh my God, like, land shark. Yeah. Ridiculous.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I guess that was part of Laura's personality that really clicked with me in a lot of ways, where I was thinking of how when you take a lot of responsibility on, whenever you're, you know, maybe like a little bit too young to take that level of responsibility on, you start to find these ways of just kind of putting your body into situations and being like, I'm here physically, you know, and this is like my job to be here. And like, I don't know. I was just thinking about that and just wondering if like that had anything to do with like how you like relate to the character.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's one of the things that I loved about her is that she still had that capacity to feel pain.
Right.
And what I liked about it was that they showed her being vulnerable, but being strong in the next panel, you know, like she actually was allowed to process her vulnerability and then kind of rise up and be the tough superhero. But throughout most of her story arcs, like she's thrown into situations that are common for a lot of girls, especially right. like girls in the world today. It's like those situations, seeing them actually play out and seeing her conquer them and actually like get heal from them and move on to the next thing, I think was super important. And then when they kind of did the whole new Wolverine story arc, they still kind of touch on that with her character now that she has, like, her little sister to raise. Like, yeah. I love Honey Badger. But,
of course.
Oh, cute. They kind of, they changed her character a bit. She's more Wolverine than she is Laura Kinney.
Right.
And that kind of bugs me. Like, I would love to see more about of Laura, like, actually Laura's story. And not so much revisiting Wolverine and kind of yeah. replaying that.
Well, and like you were saying, turning her into like this masculine thing that she doesn't have to be, right? Like she doesn't have to be what Wolverine was to be a valid hero mm-hmm. or to be someone we look up to. And I think that's the same thing. I mean, I'm just piecing this together as we talk, but like you were saying with Miles, is like Miles is so influenced by Peter. I mean, even look at Into the Spider-Verse mm-hmm. and you have to wonder like, oh, what could Miles be if Miles didn't have to be Spider-Man?
Exactly.
Like Miles could be such an incredible hero in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll be thinking about this for like the rest of my life.
Took you down the rabbit hole. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I love it. Please. You know, I was also on your website. I was looking at your portraiture, your drawings of celebs, and I just love them. I mean, Jason Momoa, my God. You should go look at it, folks. Quite the portrait. And I'm just curious, like, how do you decide who you're drawing? Where do you get your inspiration for those from?
I've always loved drawing people, actually. Like, portraits are kind of my, like, de-stress and stop thinking about stuff, because being an artist, you know, it has the capacity to be very rewarding, and then it also has the capacity to be very soul-crushing when you deal with certain clients and when you're doing graphic design and, like, late paychecks and all of the crazy stuff that comes with being an artist. So portraits, I've always been able to just kind of lose myself in, like, drawing people. A lot of the portraits I did actually are people who passed away. Mm. So I have Leia on there and Alan Rickman. I do have a Bowie that I have not finished, which I need to finish. But
yeah, your Leia, I just was like, oh, it's so emotionally evocative. Like you can tell you were really connected to her when you were drawing it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it feels good, you know, because I feel like Leia is... Yes, she is everyone's because, but really she's ours, right? Like, y'all got your fucking Luke Skywalker and your goddamn Han Solo, and I get General goddamn Organa, okay? Like, I'm pretty happy about it. When people were like, she shouldn't have been able to move through space like that, I was like, well, you shouldn't be able to be near me because I will beat you down. Because of course she has the Force, right? Of course she has the Force. Thank you.
It's in her family.
Right? But. Oh, we can all do whatever we want, whenever we want, but a woman using the Force? That is basically all the commentary on Star Wars.
Right.
God. Okay, Oscar Isaac can stay, though. You know, He can stay. I love that he's currently work, like every panel he's on, they're like, oh, so what's up with like Finn and
Poe? Like,
and
he's like, they should have been boyfriends. They should have been boyfriends.
They're in bed together.
Actually, it's funny that you say that, because that scene where Rose kisses like Finn, I felt skeezed out. I was like, sexual harassment. She broke the bubble. it freaked me out, because I saw no chemistry between them whatsoever. No. And that's like, I don't know, that's like a little mini pet peeve of mine when people just randomly kiss people. I'm like, there's a bubble there. There, you have to like feel that out. You can't just like rush in and kiss somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, that can't be how things.
Bless Rose Tico. I love Rose. Don't get us wrong. But like,
yeah, that's interesting, because that couple, I don't really...
No, I'm
I
not didn't here
see
for
it. Mm-mm. Yeah, I didn't see it throughout the movie, and then when, like, seriously, when she kissed him, it, like, really weirded me out. But I think if in the next one, if it turned out that he didn't like her, I think that would actually be a better story arc than if he suddenly was like, oh, I loved you the whole time, you just didn't see it.
Trying to, like couple everyone off. Like, it's one of my pet peeves, too, where they're like, at the end of... I'm sorry, we're going to just talk about Voyager. At the end of Voyager, like, after they've... Yep, Kate's paying attention now. After, like, making it clear that there is nothing, you know, Chakotay has a thing for Janeway, and then, you know, we all think that Seven of Nine and Janeway have a thing, and I'm sorry if this is too obscure for everyone, get over it. But then at the end, they're like, Chakotay and Seven of Nine, we're always in love. And, like... Even Jerry Ryan was like, what the fuck? Like, you told me literally not to play this like we were in love, and then you just shoehorned it in at the end. It just makes me want to punch somebody. It's, like, awful. They did that in The Magicians recently with, like, ugh, I can't even get into that.
Yeah. I'm just like, what did you mean?
Are they? That's how I feel reading all of that. Like, was it
yeah.
Gay. Headcanon, gay. Yeah. That's why we have fanfic.
Yes.
Hallelujah.
Archive of our own.
I don't even know what the website is. Archiveofourown.com?
.org.
.org.
.gov.
.nz.
Wow.
It's actually just based in New Zealand.
So. Wow. But actually, the portrait question, Jason Momoa and The Rock, was just because I wanted to draw them.
Yeah. So pretty. Like, I look at The Rock and I'm like, sometimes I'm mad about your politics, but I'm never mad about your body. Don't have it in me. And then I got Jason Momoa and I'm like, I'm happy about your politics and happy about your body. So,
oh my gosh.
Win-win. I don't know. This is what I do. I research you and then think things about your portraits,
right? Yeah, no,
creepy.
Nope. Most of the portraits were because I just liked the way people looked, or because it was a tribute to them passing away. Actually, the first portrait I ever did was Mr. Miyagi, and that actually was the first drawing I ever sold. I was 13, and I did Mr. Miyagi, and it was in I just got distracted because my 2-year-old's right there. It was in a coffee shop, and somebody walked in and he saw the drawing, and he was actually friends with Pat Morita, and it was right after he had died. And so he was like, oh, can I buy that? And I was like, no. I was like really proud of it. And it was like my first portrait, really. And he was like, he had to like fight me for it. And then he was like, well, like I knew him and it would really mean a lot. I was like, fine. Okay. Yeah. Like, all right. It will serve you better. So he bought it, but it was pretty funny because I was like clutching to that thing. I was like, no, I loved Pat Morita. I don't want to give it away.
Interesting business model. You can't have my art.
I was 13.
I love it. I'm not critiquing it. I think it's brilliant. I wish I'd known you at 13. That sounds adorable.
I was like, everything else was actually for sale except for that one thing.
Not Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah, I know. Well, especially because like Mr. Miyagi totally reminds me of my dad. Like my dad is just this little Buddha guy. So he's been called Yoda and Mr. Miyagi. So yeah, I was like, nope, I don't want to sell it. But I ended up selling it to him. So I was like, you're lucky you knew him, because if you didn't know him, I probably would have sold it.
It'd be hanging over your bed to this day.
Right. No, definitely in the portfolio, just because I was so happy with it.
Yeah. I love it.
What have conventions changed a lot since you first started being involved in organizing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot. I would like to see more of a push towards independent creators.
Yeah.
It's also what we kind of mentioned just with the rehashing superheroes. It's very rare that you actually have that highlight on independent creators.
Right, definitely.
And then just in the convention scene, it's so much fan art and so many pinups. And, like, while that is awesome and there's this weird little gray copyright area for convention artists,
right.
There's not as much push for artists to actually do things that make their own name.
Right.
They're constantly kind of doing the fan art thing, and that eventually is, like, going to run out, and then they don't have a way of kind of making their name or their art, because their niche is the fan art.
Right, yeah.
And that's, I think that's something I'd like to see more push and more encouragement towards creators to actually do their own thing, like, whatever that is. And even if it is the, where they want to draw for the big companies, like, that they're actually doing more than just conventions to get into those drawing for the big companies. And the art walls, sorry, minor mini rant, the art walls drive me a little crazy.
Yeah.
Just because the, when most conventions have that standard of 8 feet tall, and, like, Denver Pop Culture Con does not hold that at all. There's a lot of times where those
bigger
art walls are, like, 9-10 feet tall, and they end up blocking people. And so then they block the, like, independents that are actually trying to get their characters out there.
Right, yeah. I was thinking about that, that I've tabled at comic conventions before, and generally what the deal is you are surrounded by people who are selling, like, T-shirts and fan art, mm-hmm. and so, like, you're the one comics person in, like, a very long row of, like, people selling T-shirts, and it just seems like a weird thing to experience at a comic convention, I guess. Like,
yeah. I mean, like, I love the merch, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm a fan, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
I love being able to see other people's renditions of, like, their favorite characters and
totally.
Everything.
Yeah.
But that's the, like, I think there's that weird little area where where's the line that you draw, where, like, here's a really cool rendition of Steven Universe, and then here's also my other stuff. So
yeah.
you can kind of use that Steven Universe as, like, the eye grab, but then you can sell your own stories or something like that. But when
right.
then there's all the artists who are amazing artists, like, they're really super skilled. I'd love to see them do things that are their own.
Right. I was thinking, too, in Zine Fest, they had to adopt a rule that was only, it was like 80% has to be zines at your table or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know why people did that for a long time. And then I went to one where it wasn't like that. And I was like, oh, because people are selling, like, glittery T-shirts on either side of me. And I, like, didn't sell a single zine, like, the whole time I was there or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe they'd have to adopt something like that going forward.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I know Pop Culture Con's gotten a little bit better about wanting to have more diversity besides just the fan art.
Sure.
And then I think there's just, like, a thin line there that you have to figure out, because, like I mentioned, those fan art artists are amazing.
Right.
They are
yeah.
super talented, so they shouldn't be discredited as artists.
Of course.
But I'd love for them to be encouraged to do something more than just the fan art.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, it feels, I'm seeing parallels, so tell me if I'm way off base, but between the way that some comic artists end up really just doing Marvel or DC's work, or maybe Dynamite, but we love Dynamite, so I'm not talking shit. But, you know, they really, that's what they end up doing, instead of, and then they end up putting their own creative work on the back burner, on the back burner, on the back burner, and then just don't get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's incredible that people like Vita Ayala are, like, finding that balance
right.
and creating a remarkable amount of independent work that is high profile. I mean, they're doing James Bond, you know, coming
mm-hmm.
up, which is pretty incredible. But at the same time, it's not the norm. You know, I'm not seeing
yeah.
that for most people who are writing and illustrating comics.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a really good point. I think there is space. I mean, I want to read more independent stories. We're constantly trying to find more and more independent comics to, like, read. So if you're listening, or if you're in the audience and you have an independent comic, like, send it to us. Like, we want to read it. We want to review it. We want to help you find your audience.
We talk about them on the show too. So
yeah.
whenever we find new ones.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and I feel like most of, like, I mean, if you look at, like, Sana Takata, like, she started out as X-23, you know, drawing for that, but now she's got Monstrous.
Right.
And it's, when you see creators do that, there's so much more that can be said in independent comics, and that's actually their perspective. That's actually something that's coming from their heart. That's their story. So it actually broadens the world a little bit more. When you end up working for Marvel and DC, you're very stuck to their agenda. And it's kind of the same thing in terms of Comic-Cons when you're doing art for like the fan art and everything, you're actually stuck to what the popular culture likes. Yeah. You're not actually having that freedom to be able to express yourself as an artist in some ways, because there are like the nudity things and some of the stuff that might say something to you as an artist, you can't actually express it because you're like, okay, I'm the pinup artist, so therefore I have to have pinups of all of Marvel and DC, and that's the only thing that you end up showing. Mm-hmm. You don't actually showcase the stuff that might have come from your heart or your soul. It's just like the things that you hide away and you draw in your room instead of actually being able to have an audience for that and possibly being able to touch other people in that way.
Totally. And so let's look at the other half of that, the consumer. Like, what would you tell people is the best way to then support people doing their independent work as well?
I think people know what they like. And just because it's not specifically Steven Universe doesn't mean that you can't not like it. There's styles that look very similar to Steven Universe, and it's kind of that being an open mind. Like, if you love Steven Universe and you see somebody whose art is super similar, why not look into their independent artwork and their independent story? Because it could be very similar to Steven Universe, and then it's a branch off story that you get to learn more of, and then that can be your new fandom. Doesn't mean it replaces Steven Universe, it's just another story that you fall in love with.
Totally. I love when I find a comic that's like an independent comic that maybe other people aren't reading, or, and this is like a terrible example, I'm like blanking on ones that actually no one's heard of, but I remember going from Kelly Sue DeConnick's Captain Marvel to Bitch Planet, and I was like, oh, okay, now we're talking. You know, where she's like, oh, well, shit, I don't have to do what Marvel says anymore. Let's make everyone fat and black and Asian and awesome and bitchy and, like, great, let's go with it. And that really, for me, helped me start to see, like, oh, my gosh, of course there's limitations when you're in this hyper-commercial setting versus mm-hmm. a more independent setting.
Well, and then also, like, comics and art in general is really a reflection of your time. So it's really a reflection of the things that are going on to you personally, but also the things that you're dealing with in your world. And when you're working for a giant corporation, aka Disney, you end up in that situation where your perspective doesn't matter. What everybody in the consumer is saying that they need, then that's what's going to matter. I mean, it's like them taking the ancient one and turning her into a white woman because...
Perfect.
You know, China, like, that's, they're like, no, we're selling to them, so we have to cater to them. We can't actually show a character and be true to that character's origin because we have to make money.
Well, and I think the other way I've heard it described is, yes, that's one directionality. And the other direction to think about it is the people who are in charge of these companies are racist, are homophobic, are classist, are sexist, the list goes on. So then they can justify themselves with the market and say, no, oh my God, we could never acknowledge that Elsa might be gay. Oh my God, Elsa can't be gay. It's Frozen. Because no one will watch it in China. And it's like, okay, but you're also an asshole. So there's
yeah.
that.
And that's, I mean... I've been noticing patterns with that with the Disney remakes and how they're putting diversity in, but they're putting diversity in a way that erases history, yeah. which I'm really not okay with because it just, you can't erase history, you grow from it. And like the new Lady and the Tramp, my husband hated it because he loves Lady and the Tramp, and it was pretty bad. If they had retold Lady and the Tramp in modern day, it actually would have been way better. But because they tried to retell it back in Victorian times,
oh God.
They did that, but they made Darling a black woman. And then they made her family, like, black in high society Victorian New York. So it was kind of like, that's not, like, interracial couple in Victorian New York? No, that would not have happened. Like, and they had, like, a really nice house and everything, and then her, like, Aunt Sarah is, like, this super Victorian lady, like, they're big money. I was like, that's not, like, in our history, that's not something that would have been okay. There's a lot of struggle that people went through in that time period that you need to acknowledge because it happened.
Yeah. It seems like sometimes what we take as a request for representation, people are like, oh, I'll just paint rainbows and Skittles.
Exactly.
Like, this will be fine. And I think an amazing counterexample, which the rights of which are problematic, and we can talk about, mostly Sarah can talk about, is Watchmen. The new Watchmen is grappling with race in a way that the world of Watchmen wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
under Alan Moore's control. I love you, Alan Moore. Don't be mad at me. But it really is taking it seriously and saying, like, what would it mean if a superhero won the Vietnam War? It would mean something.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't just be like, oh, check, history, moving on, you know? Yeah. And then to say, like, what would it be like to have superheroes who don't look like the people are supposed to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are better ways to grapple with these issues. Mm-hmm. And and that's an alternate history. You know, like, that's not saying that things are going to be exactly like they are now, but the parallels are what make it so potent. Mm-hmm. Or what make it, when you watch Regina King fight racists, you're like, fuck, that's just like our world, only slightly different, but also terrifying. And that's, I think that deals with the problems that we have versus occluding them.
Yeah, and it's the Band-Aid, because it's like, see, we have diversity and black representation in a big Disney movie, but we just, you know, negated the fact that in history this would not have happened. And Disney has a habit of doing that, where they're like, yeah, we were super crazy racist because Disney was super crazy racist.
Oh, yeah.
And that he's a product of his time. And, I mean, Donald Duck wore a swastika and fought as a Nazi. Like, those are things that happened that I feel like need to be acknowledged, because where they are now, it shows growth. It's not we've always been, you know, happy, perfect little Disney, and we didn't actually need to grow from any struggles. We're perfect. Like,
the WB has started running before some of their old cartoons. I don't know if you've seen this. A disclaimer that says, these are a representation of the time. There are going to be things in here that are not okay by our standards today. And I, you know, part of me is just like, also like, stop playing that fucking cartoon. Like, maybe we could just make new cartoons. I don't know. But also I was like, well, I, you know, that's an effort, but what do you think of that?
I actually like the idea of acknowledging it, but making new cartoons.
Mm.
Like, I don't think you should erase it or revisit it, essentially, because it happened. That's part of the history. It's part of where you got to where you are now. And I don't like the erasing things. So, like, I like the disclaimer of, this is a reflection of the times. So, yeah, there's things that are not okay here. Check out this new thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
And then you can go and look at the new thing that's, like, way, way better.
But yeah, and it's also, like, just fucking hire creators who are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we actually know how to make this better. Like, again, just going to come back to it because I've been watching it a lot lately. Watchmen. Like, when you have a writer's room that is diverse, you're going to have better results in terms of racism in particular. And then, I mean, storytelling in general.
Yeah.
And I think that that's just really disappointing that we can't. Like, I feel like half of us get it, and then half of us are like, but I don't understand why. Like, why does it matter what someone's race is? And it's like, I don't know. Why does it matter? You're racist. Like, that's why. The racism is why.
Well, and it's perspective. I mean, you can tell somebody's story, but it's really not your perspective. You're either way, you're going to put your own perspective on that story.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, I mean, with my comic, Cowie, it's a Hawaiian comic. So I had to send it off to, like, Oahu and get a bunch of people to weigh in on it. Because the first time I released it, it wasn't on par with being culturally responsive. And now that we're re-releasing it, I have Hawaiian artists and I've had people look at the story. But I still acknowledge that that story came from me. Like, it is inspired by, and it brings in a lot of cultural references of Hawaiian mythology, and particularly their story of Beauty and the Beast, of like the goddess Pele and Pua, but like it comes from me. It's not from a Hawaiian person. So if a Hawaiian person were to tell that story, it would be very different in the voice that they use. And even though I've had people look over it and they like it and they love it, it's a story of something that I fell in love with, told from my perspective. And I think that's really the most important thing, is to acknowledge that you may love something, but it is always going to be your perspective. The only way you're going to get the perspective of that community is to have that community tell that story.
Right. Totally.
So,
I was like, we have so many questions.
I was just thinking about that because you see that a lot with like queer representation. You'll see like, you know, the straight guy who is writing and doing the whole series or something, and it's always like, I just speaking as a lesbian, I just don't know if this is something that I would say, or if anybody I've ever met would say, or if you've ever met a lesbian. So.
Oh my God. I read a novel that I will name, The Magicians, and he literally describes Alice's breasts as heavy like 13 times. And I was like, I would like you to come in person, sir, and describe to me what a heavy breast is. Because I've touched a lot of breasts, including my own.
That's heavy.
I wouldn't use... Okay, heavy in that way. I don't think he meant it that way, Sarah. I'm not going to give him that credit.
Whoa.
Yeah, Jesus. Also, stop describing women's breasts. Fuck, man. Do you not see anything else about a woman?
Well, it's just like you're thinking that, like... You go through life just thinking about that all of the time or something. Like, I wonder what's going on with my boobs right now. I'm just looking in the mirror and noticing and like...
Oh my God, like all those like jokes about like if men described you, like how would they describe you?
Right.
Good stuff.
Twitter. Yeah, not it's Twitter. Always like if women lived like that, or if people who have breasts lived like that, they would always be thinking about their breasts, which is like not really how it works in life.
I'm like, I forget I have them the whole time.
It was like, just think about like whatever other body part, like if you were just thinking about your feet all the time, like, ooh, my elbow is heavy. Nubile foot.
Nubile foot. Oh. Nubile foot. Joss Whedon would love that.
Yeah.
Oh, good God. Okay. Pull it together.
I think we're at about time, but I wanted to talk maybe just about what you have going forward, because we're like right into that new year. So what's going to be happening in 2020 for you?
Well, we're working on Iacon.
Yeah.
And getting Cowie out there, which has been interesting because it's 100 pages. So it's been...
Yeah.
We've had printing issues and overseas printing issues and all of that fun stuff. So that's definitely on the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly just getting my scarves out there and connected, and then getting Cowie out there and working on Iacon and kind of developing how we can kind of change our business. We had a couple of changes in our staff recently. So now we're just trying to figure out what our next direction is. Cause I've always wanted, Aya Studios is my company with my husband, by the way. We do publishing and all kinds of other stuff, but I've always looked at it as I wanted it to be a resource for artists. So even though we do publishing, I wanted it to be more of a kickstart for independent artists.
Nice.
So we'll publish you, but then we don't own you. Because that is the thing with a lot of publishing companies. Once you're published, you're owned by them. And I don't like the idea of owning people.
Right.
And so we were looking at it as more of a kickstart and more of an education follow-up. So not being the company that owns you, but the company that educates you against being owned. And following up with different classes. We've done a couple classes on reservations having to do with how you tell your story and like really getting your voice out there. And then this summer, I actually have a class on getting kids to go beyond the pages of a comic book. So once they create their character, how do you implement that change in reality outside of the actual comic book?
I love how every time it's like, people are like, oh, well, I just have. And then it's like every person we ever interview has 7,000 things going on. And then they're like, and plus I'm a mom.
I'm just changing the face of comics. It's no big deal. It's just my thing. Amazing. Let us know if there's ever anything we can do to support, if we can share, if you have things coming out. That's what we're about. We want to create a community here. That's the point of Bitches on Comics to us, is to create a community of people who've got each other's backs. We really appreciate your time. I think we're done. Yeah?
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you guys for having me.
Please follow us on Twitter, on Instagram. We're at Bitches on Comics. If you have extra bones you want to throw our way, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/bitchesoncomics.
We have all kinds of cool stuff on there where you get extra long episodes. We do reading lists. We do where we get drunk and talk about comics.